Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sanctions imposed on Vladimir Putin's inner circle and officials in the new Crimean government in response to Russia's annexation of Crimea. With Senator John McCain, who wants a far more significant response, deriding Obama's response, saying that sanctioning only seven Russians is wholly inadequate at this stage. We'll look into whether these targeted sanctions will work to punish Putin and deter him from going after more of Ukraine's territory. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us. Then we'll examine evidence so far in the mysterious disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 and its 239 crew and passengers, and speak with Dr. R. John Hansman, who is a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT and head of its Humans and Automation Division, as well as director of the International Center for Air Transportation. We'll discuss the latest speculation about what might have happened to the airliner and what evidence exists to support the growing number of theories about the fate of the plane and its passengers. Then finally, we'll speak with an active airlines pilot, Patrick Smith, who blogs at askthepilot.com and is the author of Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel, questions, answers, and reflections. We'll discuss the Malaysian government's current focus on the airliner's crew and the possibility of suicide as a motive, as was the case in an earlier incident in 1999 when an EgyptAir Boeing 767 passenger jet leaving JFK Airport was deliberately crashed into the sea by a member of the flight crew. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And, Scott, the sanctioning, as I mentioned in the opening, of seven Russian officials, some in Putin's inner circle, others in the Duma, and the rest either Ukrainian or Crimean officials, have already been greeted with derision by Senator John McCain. What do you think will be the impact of these sanctions?
Well, I think we're going to look at a steadily ratcheting series of sanctions coming in. The first sanctions that are being discussed are very, very narrowly targeted on individuals in immediate proximity to Putin and individuals who have otherwise played a significant role in the transfer of Crimea to Russia. I think that there is much to be said for these sorts of sanctions. I mean, generally, of course, in Washington, the neoconservatives have ridiculed sanctions as a tool, have dismissed them as ineffective, but studies that have been done over time looking at sanctions in places like Iraq and Iran, and in many other cases, including the historical sanctions levied against apartheid South Africa, have showed that actually sanctions were reasonably effective in almost all of these cases, but they had some negative aspects, particularly if we look at the sanctions in Iraq. They affected children. They affected the flow of medications. So the tendency now is to start the process with much more narrowly focused sanctions. And here they're going after the immediate Putin entourage, and they're going after they basically want to make their lives less pleasant, preclude them from being able to travel to the West, own property in the West, or do business outside the country. And I think these sanctions will be effective in achieving that, because it won't just be the United States. It'll also be the European Union and a number of other countries that will join in.
Well, of course, already Vladislav Surkov is known as the Grey Cardinal. He's Putin's presidential aide. It's not going to affect him. His only connections to America are Allen Ginsberg and Jackson Pollock. So I don't quite know what he means by that. But the others, and including, of course, the Duma member, Yelena Mezlina, who wrote the anti-gay law, she again have said, well, I never go to America and I don't have any property there. So the Europeans have sanctioned 21 individuals, which for the EU to agree on anything, given the disparity amongst the nations, is pretty significant. But again, that was a list of 120 down to 21. So there seems to be a lot of caution, if not confusion, here.
Yeah, but I think we'll see the list and we'll see the sanctions grow over time. I think that there's a clear plan that this be ratcheted step by step. And yes, it's easy for them to say we don't travel to the United States. Well, in fact, actually, an awful lot of the elite class of Russians do travel to the United States. But far beyond that, the Grey Cardinal insisted he didn't have bank accounts outside of Russia. And let me just express a firm doubt about that. Most of the Russian elites today have exported most of their capital outside of the country, and they control it mostly through European and offshore institutions. Those who've arrived and become members of the Russian elite tend to send their children to be educated in Switzerland or England. They tend to have apartments and country homes in England or around Geneva or Zurich and other locations. So these sanctions will definitely affect them. In fact, if you take an inventory of yachts that are now docked in the Porte d'Azur in France, you'll find a majority of the yachts are in the hands of Russian oligarchs.
But they so far have not been sanctioned, right? I mean, these are the people that commingle Putin's ill-gotten gains. He's allegedly one of the richest people in the world. That's being held off. So is what's going on here, Scott Horton, the recognition that Crimea is lost and that what Putin is being warned with now is that worse will come if you take eastern Crimea, which is what he appears poised to do.
Eastern and southern Ukraine, I think.
I'm sorry, eastern and southern Ukraine. Yeah, he appears to be poised to do that. And frankly, I think he will, but that's just my opinion.
I think what drives it is a sense that military response to what's happened in Crimea is impossible to justify. But you can't fail to do anything. You have to take some sort of steps. And the steps should target those who've instigated this entire scheme. And as I said, I expect to see it become more and more over time. But I think it is going to focus on those who are responsible and not be much more broadly based, affecting the broader Russian population. But I'd say we are going to see a back and forth rhythm here. So Russia has responded immediately to the actions of the United States and to the Europeans with its own banning orders. And I think I think we may see a sort of ping pong effect back and forth. With some escalation.
But to the point, Scott Horton, that the West recognizes that Crimea is lost, but they would like to warn Putin against taking eastern Ukraine. Is that an effective way to go? Then, in other words, you do these targeted sanctions, which are targeted against a handful of his people involved in the Duma in this decision, the crooks that are now running Crimea, Aksionov, the previously known as the Goblin, a minor gangster, and Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Parliament, who's responsible for a huge real estate scam where thousands of people in a Ponzi scheme put up money for apartment buildings that were never built, and then of course Yanukovych himself. Those are the people that they've targeted now. Then that is fairly narrow. So are they holding in reserve on the back burner that we're going to go after your cronies now, Putin, if you go into eastern Ukraine?
I think there are going to be further steps, and I think you're also going to see steps taken by the European Union and the United States. They're designed to bolster and strengthen the position of Ukraine. So I think you'll see a lot of support for the Ukrainian government. Of course, this was put before the U.S. Congress and was blocked by the Republicans rather amazingly. John McCain threw a fit about that over the weekend. But, you know, I think that, that support is going to be offered and it will be important. And you know, the question is, you know, whether thresholds into military support are crossed.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So just what exactly did the Republicans block and McCain had a fit over?
Yes, well, John Kerry went to the Hill requesting funds for the Ukrainian government, basically a financial bailout that would have included security support for the government. And this was part of a package that was negotiated between the U.S., the Ukrainians, and the Europeans. It was the U.S. component. And the U.S. said, you know, leading Republicans refused to support it because provisions provided payments for the IMF and the World Bank. Of course, the main vehicle for these, for the financial support, was always going to be the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF particularly.
So these Republicans want to get tough on Putin, but not do anything to help the Ukrainian people, which, you know.
Well, they're refusing to do what the Ukrainians most urgently need and have most urgently demanded.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that that's awfully petty, and I think at some point they'll relent and it'll pass after they've thrown their tantrum.
Well, what is the strategy vis-a-vis? I mean, I guess at this point everybody's on pins and needles wondering what Putin's going to do next. He's massed that army on the Ukrainian border of eastern Ukraine, and the same MO is being applied to eastern Ukraine as was to Crimea, where they send in Russian provocateurs and thugs and manufacture pogroms and keep beating the drum on the idea that the new Ukrainian government are a bunch of Nazis and anti-Semites, which, by the way, I don't understand why the U.S. and Europeans don't make this new government repudiate those people and kick them out. You know, why are they in there in any case?
Well, they are a part of the government. Of course, I'd say they're just as many neo-Nazis in Russia as there are in Ukraine. So
Right. It's
a phenomenon that's common to the entire region, and it is something of a problem and somewhat troubling. But, you know, the threat we're looking at, it's difficult to assess exactly how far Putin intends to go here. But let's say there are three potential phases. I mean, the first already taken involves reducing Crimea to Russian control and now incorporating Crimea into the Russian Federation directly. The next would be taking control over the southern and eastern provinces where a majority of the population is Russian-speaking, and there are a very, very large number of ethnic Russians. Where you note that some of the measures that were taken in Crimea seem now to be in the process of implementation. And the third would be to topple the government in Kiev itself and to install a puppet state, a sort of Prague 1968 solution. And, of course, when Yanukovych was toppled, there were papers that were seized at his residence suggesting that he and the Russian government were in the process of planning exactly that sort of maneuver. So it seems to me that that certainly can't be ruled out. And I think the response, the Western response, is going to be keyed to that. So I think, Crimea, it is much more difficult to strike aggressively against Russia, certainly to pursue a military option based on the Crimea. The bottom line is that Crimea, through most of modern history, has been part of Russia anyway. A large majority of the population is Russian. It became a part of Ukraine as a result of Nikita Khrushchev spending one evening with too much vodka and deciding he would give it as a gift to Ukraine, and Nikita, of course, being a Ukrainian. So that's always been a rather weird quirk of history. And I think the question there is not that it's rejoined to Russia, it's the way that this transpires, ignoring the Ukrainian constitution and any formal or proper process, or even really a fair and open referendum allowing people to express their real views. But I think a military action in the eastern and southern parts of Ukraine would be a far more serious development.
Well, Scott Horton, Scott Horton, professor at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs, and he served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bono, among other activists in the former Soviet Union. I've spoken to a number of Russians and Americans who know Putin, and yesterday Masha Gessen, who wrote a book about him and had met him in the Kremlin, Bill Browder, who's the biggest investor in Russia until in 2005, he became a non-person for running afoul of Putin, and his lawyer, Magnitsky, was murdered by the regime, and the Americans have passed a measure called the Magnitsky Act that sanctions Russian officials involved in the killing of Magnitsky, and that could be expanded to Putin and others, presumably. But what I'm being told is that Putin, this is working out for him domestically, and that his MO is basically to keep the Russian public distracted from the fact that he's stealing the country blind. And Sochi was a great distraction, and now this is a great distraction, so that he could string this out for months. So what do you make of that scenario?
Well, I think that's a sound analysis, and I think Masha Gessen's book about Putin is probably the best available book about his life. It shows the circumstances in which he grew up and his training and his career. This man is a career KGB officer, and he has that training and that background. And I think quite significantly now, as these steps are being taken, he's being counseled and advised by an inner coterie of former intelligence officers, not by his foreign minister and the other senior officials of the government you think would be involved. But I think it's correct that the natural political reflex inside of Russia to the developments in Korea and the Crimea will be to cheer this and view it as a dramatic success by Putin. But I'm not so sure that 2 or 3 years down the road it's going to be viewed that way. In fact, I think at that point, if this produces a Cold War, something like a Cold War, if it produces a deterioration of Russian relations with Europe, a loss of an important Russian market, a loss of the right to the ability to travel, to take vacations in Europe, to own property there, I think people will be very upset by that. And I think they will understand that Putin is a kleptocrat. I think most of them understand that already. He's someone who has amassed enormous wealth, and the population as a whole is not benefiting. And I think he, at the outset of his rule, when he first became prime minister, he sparked the war in the North Caucasus. And he did that as a neat way of distracting from the economic shortcomings of his administration. I think we're seeing the Ukrainian operations today for more or less the same reason. I mean, he's not delivering on the promise of a wealthy and prosperous Russia. Far from it.
And the growth is going down to 1%. If indeed in the long run the Europeans find a way, because they've apparently got enough gas until next winter, but if they transition away from Russian gas to other sources in the long term, that's a huge loss for Russia. It's their main source of income. So it's nothing that he's doing is particularly in the interest of Russia in the long term, but in the short term, they've been very good for his poll numbers, and that may be all that matters with this guy and his small coterie of KGB thugs, none of whom were particularly distinguished officers, by the way. Putin's career was very undistinguished. They were much cleverer people in the KGB than he was.
That's exactly right. But I would say in the meantime, while his poll numbers on the whole may be improving or may be very good, if you look at the key indicators, Russian elites in Moscow and St. Petersburg, that was an audience that roundly supported Putin 3 years ago, and I think was the mainstay of support for his government, and they have steadily become more and more disaffected at Putin. And today they largely see him as a failed president, as very, very corrupt and not really very smart. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for him.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
Again, Scott Horton is a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the evidence so far in the mysterious disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. R. John Hansman, who is a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's head of the Humans and Automation Division. He's also director of the International Center for Air Transportation, and his current research interests focus on advanced cockpit information systems, including flight management systems, air ground data link, electronic charting, advanced alerting systems, and flight crew situational awareness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. R. John Hansman.
Happy to be here.
And I suppose the evidence has led people to understand that this is not the plane didn't crash over on its way to Thailand. It comes from the fact that the ACARS, the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, was turned off before the last communication from the cockpit, and subsequently, even though these radar tracks from the Malaysian military were available back last Wednesday, it's taken the authorities in Malaysia some time to come to this conclusion. Now they appear to be looking into the possibility of a land route over Asia heading up towards Kazakhstan. What's your latest understanding of where the search is focused now?
So, they're searching both to the north and to the south, and I can explain that in a minute why they're doing that. But the Malaysians have actually shifted their timeline a little bit. So it turns out that the last signal from the ACARS system was before the last radio communication, but it was not expected to give another update or signal until after the communication. So they don't really know exactly when the ACARS went down. And that actually sort of changes a little bit of the assumptions of what may happen. With regard to the search area, there was a satellite communication device still operating on the airplane. It wasn't sending any information, but it was getting pings, just like your cell phone will ping the tower occasionally to know its location. So from the satellite pings, they know the distance the airplane was from the satellite. That ends up drawing an arc on the Earth. So there's one part of that arc is to the north, that's up towards Kazakhstan and in Central Asia. And then the southern part of that arc goes through the Indian Ocean down by Australia. We don't really know. All that we know is that the airplane was on that arc about 7.5 hours after takeoff. But we don't know where at all it is on there, so the search area is still quite vast.
So it could have been on either of the two arcs, the one that went south into the Indian Ocean and the one went north into Central Asia.
That's right. They've only terminated the arcs to the west because the airplane didn't have enough fuel to go that any further than that. And I presume they reason why they have they don't have the arc in the middle is because they've already sort of searched that area with the radar data they had access to.
So one of the things that I find queasy about this whole story is the fact that these passengers, the fate of them is still unknown, and of course they have next of kin, and you know one doesn't want to get into ghoulish speculation, but it does appear that the first act, once the plane was diverted, was to fly up above its rated ceiling to 45,000 feet. And some have speculated that that was to get longer range, and others have speculated that that was a way to asphyxiate the passengers, thus neutralizing them. What do you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't put a lot of credibility in the reports of the altitude. It turns out that one of the systems that was shut down on the airplane, the transponder, is the one that gives accurate altitude reports of the airplane. So the way they were inferring altitude were from military radars that did not have a particularly good look angle on the airplane and didn't. So I don't think that the measurements of altitude were very precise. However, if they are correct, it's not a huge deal from a pressurization standpoint to go up to 45,000 feet. So I doubt that that was the cause. And the airplane is very, very, very difficult to fly at 45,000 feet. So the speed difference between where you get trouble due to supersonic effects and where you have trouble due to stall is very small. We actually call that the coffin corner. So I'm not sure it went up that high. And even if it did, I don't think it was done intentionally to try to disable the passengers.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. R. John Hansman, who's a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's head of the Humans and Automation Division. He's also director of the International Center for Air Transportation, and his current research focuses on advanced cockpit information systems, including flight management systems, air ground data links, electronic charting, advanced alerting systems, and flight crew situational awareness. The other scenario, of course, that is being suggested here is that somehow the plane got into the radar shadow of Singapore Airlines Flight 68 and was able to go follow it all the way up into Central Asia, across India, where there's, of course, a lot of military radar, particularly when you get close to India and Pakistan and China. And that's explaining why there was no radar detection. That seems like a pretty elaborate, if not far-fetched, theory.
We're into a huge speculation and whatever. It is possible to get to fly formation with an airplane. It's actually not all that difficult. Commercial airplanes fly very steady flight paths. So it was theoretically possible that you could have linked up with another airplane and then sort of track them. The military radars would tend to, if you were close enough, would just tend to see you as a as one target, basically the targets would merge. And if you were coming from behind, the other airplane wouldn't necessarily know you were there. So, again, it's theoretically possible. I don't think we have any evidence at all that supports it.
So the other theory that it appears that the Malaysian authorities are working on, Dr. John Hansman, is the idea that one or more of the flight crew, the pilot, co-pilot, or the engineer, was somehow involved in financial or professional difficulties, and this is an elaborate form of suicide in order to collect insurance for next of kin. And that's been attributed to the possibility that it flew off into the Indian Ocean where it would never be found again. What's your understanding of that theory?
Well, I don't have any evidence. I mean, we have had cases in the past where there have been intentional suicides on the part of crew. So, you know, in any case like this, particularly where there's a suspicion of an intentional diversion, they are appropriately doing investigations on everybody on the airplane to try to understand anybody who would have a motive. So I don't have any specific evidence or data on motive there.
So just in terms of this continuing mystery then, is this something that I spoke yesterday to David Gleave in the UK who has actually dealt with a pilot suicide in order to collect insurance. That was, and of course, as we just mentioned, that's a theory that the Malaysian authorities are pursuing. But has there ever been an incident where a plane has and its passengers have been taken, you know, theft for ransom, which is the other theory that's out there?
There was a famous case in the U.S. With a hijacker D.V. Cooper, who hijacked the airplane 727, held it for ransom, got the ransom, and also got a parachute, had the pilots take off and fly and parachute it out of the airplane, and has never been heard from again. So it has happened in the past, rarely successfully.
Well, in terms of that theory, of course, speculation is it involves the Uyghurs, who are in a war against China, and that the fact that the pilots were Muslim, and perhaps there was one Uyghur aboard, but apparently nobody seems to think he was any kind of a radical. But that's the theory. And if that were the case, and if they're in the midst of how would you hide a plane of this size? There's apparently somebody's come up with a number about the 600 possible landing sites in this, projected flight path heading north. But nevertheless, it would seem to me that it would be pretty hard to hide a plane of that size.
Yeah, no, I think it's unlikely. I mean, you need a runway that's long enough to handle the airplane. Typically about 5,000 feet would probably be about the smallest they could get it into. And I think that there are about 500 airports in the entire range of airplanes so that you can go and look at those. But you would need to be able to get it on the ground without anybody noticing, which is very difficult, particularly if it's an airport that's not normally used. You would then have to have a building big enough, or hangar big enough, to put the airplane in. This is a very large airplane with a very tall tail. It won't fit in most normal hangars. And then you would have to do it, this is the biggest sort of mystery in the world, right? So nobody who had any involvement would be able to leak the information. So the fact that we haven't heard anything makes it sort of unlikely, that happened. But it's still, again, it's, theoretically possible you could land somewhere.
Well, given that you study cockpit information systems, wasn't there a case of an Egypt Air jet that it looks as though the captain decided to commit suicide with his crew and passengers? And there's some mystery over the TWA flight 880 as well.
There's very little mystery about TWA 800. That was clearly a center fuel tank explosion in Egypt Air. There was, it's pretty clear there was an intentional suicide. There was another case in Silk Air of an intentional suicide. So, there have been cases in the past where crews have intentionally committed suicide.
And we know that since the 9/11 hijackers, that they've improved cockpit door safety. But has there been any, is there any way since those incidents that you just mentioned, the Japanese and the Egypt Air incident, is there any way to avoid that possibility of a flight crew deciding to commit suicide with the plane and the passengers?
Well, the other side of the coin, when you harden the cockpit and make it the cockpit secure, is that if the crew decides to do something irrational, you don't really have anything you can do externally to prevent them, right? So, the things that are done are sort of the normal things that are done in terms of medical screening and psychological screening and hiring and things like that. But, there's always some chance that someone, either has a mental issue or emotional or psychological issue and, behaves irrationally. So, it's one of the risks we take in life.
So then, Dr. Arjun Hansman, in terms of, there's been obviously this incident has caused friction between the Chinese and the Malaysians, and I suppose there's no point in harping on the apparent ineptitude of some of the Malaysian politicians. But do you feel that time was lost that would have made a difference here?
Yeah, I think possible, particularly, as time goes on, if the airplane is in the water, the wreckage will be more dispersed. If there was an oil slick, the oil slick would be more dispersed, so it makes it harder to locate it. So I think time was lost. And, it's not unusual. Under international agreements, the country, when an airplane goes missing over international waters, The country of registration has the lead in the investigation, and other countries don't have authority unless they're asked to participate by that lead country. So I think for whatever reason, Malaysia was slow. I think they just didn't have much experience. And this is not unusual in events like this that happen in a small country that doesn't have a lot of events like this. They didn't have a professional investigation group there. They didn't have experience in how to handle, you know, the intense press scrutiny and all the information. It took them a while to get the right technical help to look at some of the data that was available. So it was slow getting going, and I do think some time on the search was lost. Obviously, they spent a lot of time looking in an area where right now it doesn't look like that's where the airplane was.
And in terms of not going to looking into the pilots and the co-pilots and the engineer, apparently, you know, they only just done that recently. And the pilot apparently had a simulator in his home. I don't imagine that's particularly peculiar. But anything that they could have gained earlier on that, we don't, I guess better late than never in terms of interviewing the families.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not sure how much that would have helped in the refining the search location. And, you know, the criminal aspect of it, I'm not sure there's any, you know, what the urgency is. Again, on the search, really, if there were people there to try to, you know, help them and then also to find the evidence before the evidence disperses.
Well, that was one of the scenarios that I discussed yesterday with David Gleave in the UK was the criminal aspect of it, that that this was theft for ransom of the plane, and they're, what, about $200 million? It was halfway through its life, so maybe it was worth $100 million, and it would be worth it for Malaysian Airways to quietly pay at least $50 million to get it back. But again, I guess...
Yeah, but it, I mean, the ransom thing, again, it's a little bit of a red herring. People, generally, the ransoms are not successful. You have to land the airplane somewhere. Once the airplane's on the ground, then you basically have a hostage standoff. You don't, there's nothing sort of unique about the situation. So it's not clear to me. I mean, and clearly we don't have a ransom situation, or we haven't heard about a ransom situation since, you know, nobody knows where the airplane is. So Malaysia Airlines clearly has not been contacted, so.
Well, I guess this is the agony for the next of kin, isn't it? They're holding out hope that these people are alive. And under what circumstances would there be a benefit to the criminals to keep these people alive unless they were ransoming back the passengers, perhaps, to the Chinese government?
I mean, this is totally sort of speculation. I mean, I don't think we don't have any evidence of this.
No.
You know, if the airplane was on the ground, I think we probably would have heard about it. I think it's more likely that the airplane is either in the water or has crashed, you know, on land somewhere and can be very difficult to find.
And that's your conclusion then?
Well, I haven't seen any evidence that would, again, if it had landed, there's very few places it can land. Hmm. All of those places have been searched. So where is the airplane if it's sitting, you know, I mean, this is not an easy airplane to get under the ground. You can't just put it in any flat piece of land. You need a runway that can bear the weight of the airplane. I just don't see any evidence. And you know, people have looked that there's there's a 777 sitting in an airport somewhere that nobody knows where it came from. Yeah. You know?
Well, but just in closing, though, Dr. John Hansman, this leads you to wonder then, why would you go to all this trouble to hijack an aircraft and go through this elaborate maneuvers to avoid detection in order to just crash it into the ocean?
Well, I mean, I don't, you know, if we knew the answer to that, we'd know where the airplane is, right? So
right.
It could have been a plan gone bad. It could still be, it's not impossible that there was some sort of mechanical problem that incapacitated the crew and the airplane continued to fly on autopilot. The original turn was back towards an emergency diversion airport. So if there was some sort of progressive problem that caused them to turn back, so that's still, you know, in the list of, you know, possibilities. And frankly, that's probably more credible than the airplane that's sitting on, at some airport, with someone waiting to hold it for hostage. You know, if it was being held for hostage, I think we would have heard about it by now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. R. John Hansman.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. R. John Hansman, who is a professor in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's head of the Humans and Automation Division. He's also director of the International Center for Air Transportation, and his current research interest focuses on advanced cockpit information systems, including flight management systems, air-ground data links, electronic charting, advanced alert systems, and flight crew situational awareness. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an active airline pilot about the disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane. I hate to go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at AskThePilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, The Continuing Mystery of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Smith.
Thanks for having me.
And I was just speaking then a minute ago with the aeronautical engineer and head of the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT and director of the International Center for Air Transportation. And the last thing he mentioned was the possibility that the turn that the plane took once it was apparently hijacked, even though that's not the word the Malaysian authorities want to use, it was consistent with a turn towards a vector for an emergency airstrip, which might indicate that there was a traumatic event on board, and that's what they're reacting to.
That could be. In fact, that's something I brought up in my blog post. If you go to askthepilot.com, my most recent post discusses that same idea, where when the plane made its turn to the west, that could be an indication of somebody commandeering the airplane, or it could be an indication that the crew was making that turn towards a diversion airport, and on the way to that diversion airport was overcome by smoke or fumes or for some other reason, they never made it, and the airplane possibly even continued on in that direction by itself after a certain point. That's just speculation, but it is conceivable.
But I guess what works against that speculation is the fact that the ACARS, the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, apparently was turned off before the last contact with the cockpit was sent to back to the Malaysian Airlines headquarters, saying something like "All's well, good night."
That does jump out at me a little bit. It does make that scenario, the diverting to another airport scenario, less likely. Meanwhile, a lot has been made about the terminology used in that final transmission, the crew saying goodbye or goodnight, or exactly how it was put, I can't recall. But those sorts of salutations are actually very common in commercial aviation when moving from one air traffic control sector to another, we always use phrases like have a good night, you know, see you later, take care, good luck, and so on and so forth. It's just basic politeness over the radio to talk in those terms when saying hello or goodbye to a particular air traffic control facility. So I'm not sure why some people have seized on that. It's to my mind, not relevant at all.
Well, it does seem that the Malaysian authorities, now that they're investigating the pilot, the co-pilot, and the flight engineer, are focusing on the possibility of suicide for perhaps insurance. There was a case of Egypt Air, and I believe of a Japanese airline as well, where the pilots or the flight crew used the plane to commit suicide and, of course, took out all the passengers as well. What's the history of that, and is there any way that since those incidents that anything has been done, if anything can be done?
Well, the incident you're referring to was the Egypt Air accident in, I believe, 1996. Plane that crashed after takeoff from Kennedy Airport when the first officer allegedly flew the airplane into the ocean, basically. And by the way, there would have on the Malaysia Airlines plane, there would have been a captain and a first officer, not a flight engineer. There would have been two crew members, captain and FO, or if you prefer, captain and co-pilot, not a third pilot. But anyway, what to say about that possibility? It's not likely, but it is possible. And as an airline pilot myself, it makes me wince a little bit. It doesn't look good. It's kind of a disrespect on all of us, and people start looking suspiciously at pilots, like, why would one of you do this sort of thing? And is this something that we should all be worried about? And no, I mean, the history of aviation is very long. Accidents, major accidents, rare as they are, there have been many, and over such a long history, I mean, just weird things once in a while happen, and that could be one of them, and perhaps it's happened again, but you know, two times in 100 years or whatever, that's not really an indication that there's some, you know, pathology here. It's not something that the average passenger really ought to be sitting back there in the cabin worrying about. It's just it shouldn't be on the passenger's radar, really, unfortunate as it is. And you know, I'm asked, well, what the airlines do? I mean, how are pilots selected, and are they screened psychologically? And I mean, yeah, I mean, pilot selection is a long, multi-step process, and most major carriers do run their new hires through some sort of professional psychological screening, and then there are medical evaluations that we have at least twice a year, and psychological evaluation is part of that. But beyond that, no, I mean, pilots aren't psychoanalyzed every time we come to work. I mean, at a certain point, you're a professional, and you're expected to carry yourself professionally and do your job professionally. And you know, in that regard, I guess it's not a whole lot different from most other professions, where at a certain point, you're just, you know, there's an expectation.
Again, I'm speaking with Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, The Continuing Mystery of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Well, of course, one has to be careful not to be ghoulish about this speculation, because the next of kin of these passengers still are holding out hope that they're alive. But when a plane disappears at high altitude, it's extremely rare, is it not? I mean, Pan Am, we know the one why that exploded over Lockerbie, and the other examples, the more recent one of Air France, it looks as though that was pilot error compounding bad information that was coming, because I believe the instrument that measures the speed was somehow impaired. I think there was a fairly serious investigation done into that. So the reason we're having this conversation is that it is extremely rare, and now we find, because planes don't drop out of the sky, but now we find there's a possibility of some kind of human intervention, and I guess that's where we're at now, is it?
Well, I think where you're going with that is towards the possibility of the plane still being out there somewhere in one piece, having landed on some remote airstrip or you know, otherwise, you know, having been smuggled into an airport somewhere, you know, there's been speculation all over the internet and even on TV about those possibilities. NPR did a thing where they came up with a possibility of you know, 600 different airports in all these different countries where the plane could have landed. I mean, conceivably, that's true. It's extremely unlikely that that occurred. As remote as some of these airports are, none of them are remote enough that you can simply sneak in a Boeing 777 without lots and lots and lots of people being aware of that fact. That it would be extraordinarily difficult to do that. And corollary to that, people are suggesting the idea that somebody did that for purposes of later using the airplane as a weapon. I mean, putting a nuclear bomb on it or some biological agent and then taking off again and flying it over a city. I don't know. That's getting a little too James Bond for me. And, you know, remember, there are hundreds or even thousands of business jets and cargo planes out there that move around the world pretty much anonymously as it is. That any one of those planes could do the job. If that's really what was going on, why would a terrorist group or somebody else steal an airplane full of people and draw all of the world's attention on the fact? It just doesn't make sense.
Sure, and you can actually buy used aircraft at any rate. If it's it seems like an awfully elaborate way to go. If you wanted to get
many,
a flying
many
bomb,
ways of,
yeah.
So many simpler ways of doing it.
It's true. There's, but the expert from England, David Glevier, was saying yesterday that the southern route that the satellite indicated as a second option, as opposed to the northern route, which is where the speculation about landing comes from, the southern route goes into the Indian Ocean, and that led to this sort of idea of the suicide scenario. Mm-hmm. The question does arise, why would you bother to take over a plane and then just fly it into the ocean?
Well, who knows? I mean, again, looking back over the whole long history of aviation and the different accidents, and you know, some of them being as weird as they've been, a lot of them too to this day are shrouded in mystery, and we just don't ever know the full answer of how they happened or why they happened. I mean, this could turn out to be just another forever unsolved mystery. You know, rare as that is in this day and age, where we almost always get to the bottom of aviation accidents, the possibility still exists that we won't. And I think people need to be willing to realize that and accept that.
Well, given that, you know, these tragedies and often result in improvements to flight safety, and of course 9/11 resulted in strengthening cockpit doors, etc., is there anything that could be done or should have been done? I mean, the only criticism I've heard is that maybe the Malaysian airliner didn't have a system that would have given more data to the outside world, either through satellites, etc. Is that your understanding?
It's hard to say what are the lessons, what can we draw from this, without really knowing what happened in the first place. That's getting way ahead. And meanwhile, you know, here's what we're up against. There's just such a lack of evidence, a lack of information. And so everybody becomes an expert, and everybody's sitting out there, you know, watching this story and thinking, well, here's how, you know, to fix it, and here's what we should have done. And a lot of people throwing out these ideas, you know, don't understand some of the complications involved. For example, why can't we live stream data constantly from an airplane up into space, back down to the ground, monitoring it constantly, you know, everywhere it is, all the time? Well, there are lots of reasons why you can't do that. It would take tremendous amounts of bandwidth, I guess, for lack of a better term. All of that information having to be streamed to a satellite, it would be extremely expensive, as well as extraordinarily challenging technologically, and that's just one aircraft, and now you've got thousands of aircraft in the air at any one time, all doing this same thing. And for what exactly? For the bizarre once every 25 years sort of incident that we're dealing with here. I don't know if that's really a smart idea, putting that much, all of those resources into something like that. I think there are better ways and smarter ways, more cost-effective ways of improving air safety.
So, Patrick Smith, in terms of your latest book, Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel Questions and Answers and Reflections, is there anything that in what we know so far that strikes you as an anomaly in terms of what we know about this crew. There were reports out of Australian television I think it was the co-pilot invited some young women into the cockpit and was showing off and smoking, etc. That's been refuted by the families. I mean, it's difficult. Again, you know, you are, of course, as you've cautioned it on a number of times, we are speculating wildly here, and it's probably something that one doesn't want to be too associated with conspiracy theories, you know.
Well, worst case scenario about the pilot having invited people in the cockpit and taken those pictures, I mean, that doesn't look good, and that's something that is really across the board forbidden at airlines all around the world. Did it happen? I'm not sure. If it did, is the context of the story exactly right, or is something just being pulled out and thrown at us by the media, and we don't really understand the details of it? But again, even worst case, sure, that's you know, it looks bad, but whether or not it has anything to do with what happened here is another question entirely.
Well, at the risk of belaboring you here, the only other scenario that's come up is that somehow this plane could have shadowed Singapore Airlines Flight 68 as it proceeded across the Andaman Sea into the Bay of Bengal and into Indian airspace and then on to India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and finally Turkmenistan before proceeding onwards for its final destination in Barcelona. Again, I suppose that's technically possible that you could merge the radar signatures, but it's...
That would be... It's possible, but very difficult, and especially when you're talking about two airplanes that large.
Right.
And then what exactly would have been the purpose for this again?
Well, the idea is that these planes...
No, I'm being rhetorical, because that goes back to what we were saying before. That's just such an elaborate and logistically difficult plot. And
right.
What again? I just... that's going all James Bond on me again. I'm just not ready to go there. But I think that people have a tendency to come up with fringe theories like that because that's human nature, especially when there's just nothing else to go on. And I think people don't want to settle for the easier explanation, which is that there was a hijacking or some sort of takeover that went bad and the airplane crashed into the ocean. That's what I think probably happened. That's the most logical and simplest explanation. So it's at this point, probably the correct one, but you know, with certain details again that we don't really know about yet. But that being the gist of it, that's where I am at this point, which in a way is further than I want to go actually, because you know, almost always in these situations, whatever theories we come up with turn out to be either totally wrong or incomplete. So I could turn out to be completely wrong about that, but that's my hunch at this point.
Well, Patrick Smith, I do appreciate you joining us here today.
Yeah, sure, anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Smith, who's an active airline pilot, air travel blogger, and author whose latest book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Question, Answers, and Reflections. He blogs at askthepilot.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, The Continuing Mystery of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.